Dog Works Radio Network presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to our 2015 Iditarod coverage here on Mushing Radio. It is day three of the event, and calling in from Southern California is my co-host. His name is Alex Stein. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great, Robert. How are things up in Willa?
Things are beautiful. It was an awesome day today. My daughter and I went out for a nice 25-mile run, and it's about 4 degrees or so a perfect time to run dogs.
Oh, that's wonderful. So it oddly cooled down after the Iditarod left town.
Yes, it did.
So we have a lot of things happening in the race right now. So I think we should just dive into it. Just first of all, a quick look at where things are. There are lots and lots of teams on the trail between Tanana and Ruby. There's 55 teams on the trail now. The first teams look like they are just about to come in the next probably 20 minutes or an hour. And we have a clump of top teams up at the front, Mitch Seavey, Dallas Seavey, Aaron Burmeister, Martin Boozer, and Ali Zirkel. And then a little bit further behind, Yor Olsom, Jesse Ryder, Pete Kaiser, Hugh Neff, and Jeff King. So, you know, those are the top teams right now, and those are, I think, would do really well.
Well, we're going to get into Brent Sass's story here in just a second, but from your following, is anybody really struggling out there? I looked at the standings. I don't have Insider or the GPS tracker, so I'm going to rely on you, but it looked like quite a few teams just recently left Manly, which is quite a ways back, if you think about it. You know, the back of the Packers there. They're running a little bit of a slow race, don't you think?
Yeah, they are. And it's specifically Trent Herbst and Ellen Halverson are way at the back. It looks like they are closing in on Tanana now. So we still, at this point, have a lot of the teams bunched up. And usually, at this point in the race, the teams have started to stretch out a little bit more. It's a bit difficult this year to track exactly where we are because the route is different, and it's a little bit of it's a little bit of an unprecedented thing to see exactly where people are compared to where we thought they would be. Given that, there's been a bunch of fresh snow on the trail. The trail seems to be fairly fast. It's also been very cold out on the trail. Temperatures at night going down to 30 or 40 below, and then warming up to, I believe, in most places, just around or a little bit below zero, which is very cold for most people in most parts of the country, in most parts of the world. But it's a very, very comfortable temperature for running dogs.
That is true.
So last night or yesterday afternoon, Brent Sass, who just won the Yukon Quest and was considered by many to be one of the favorites to, if not win this year's race, to really put in a very, very strong showing. And a lot of people had picked him for their top five or their top ten, was disqualified yesterday evening in Tanana for having a device that could be used for two-way communication. He had an iPod Touch, which is the iPod model that basically looks like an iPhone. It does almost everything an iPhone does, but it doesn't have the the telephone part of it, but you can use it to connect to the internet, and you can have apps on it. And he was using it for music, listening to music and watching movies, and said that he never had any intention to use it to connect to Wi-Fi. And apparently that device is legal on the Quest, but is not allowed in Iditarod. And someone at Manly Hot Springs had seen him using this device and thought it was a cell phone. And race marshal Mark Nordman asked him about it in Tanana, and he said, yes, I have this, and then realized that it was not a device that was allowed and was immediately disqualified.
If I could give a little bit of a musher's perspective on this, and then you and I can talk about whether it was a good rule or a bad rule. First off, I run almost every single run that I run on, I use a iPod Classic, you know, the old school style with the click wheel. And I've used that for years, and I probably have, I don't know, 14,000 songs on it that just hit shuffle and just let it go, because those miles, they are very long, and they tick pretty slowly unless you have music to listen to or something to keep you motivated, especially on those long overnight runs. And in terms of race perspective, you and I talked a little bit about this last night on Twitter. My daughter just finished up the Junior Iditarod, which is kind of the baby sister of the Big Daddy, the Iditarod. And they were very specific in talking to the kids at the meetings. They said that they could take along their iPhones, their iPod Touches, or whatever, but they sealed them in a sealable baggie, you know, one of those sort of like a freezer saver type bag. And if you were to take it out without an emergency call, you were immediately disqualified. So it was strictly an emergency measure for the kids, but they could not use them under any circumstances. And I believe that's sort of the same thing that they told the Iditarod mushers. You cannot have it under any circumstances unless, obviously, it's an emergency. And then, and of course, you are immediately disqualified. So I do know that they are very, very adamant about this rule, not only with the adults, but the juniors as well. But first, I would like to hear your opinion, Alex, not only as a mushing fan, but just as a, you know, somebody that lives in the 2015 world where everything is connected, everything is on one device, cameras, radios, alarm clocks, everything we carry in our pockets now, not when the rules were made 25 years ago.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting because, as you mentioned, a lot of people do listen to music, and this specifically, I think there's been a little bit of confusion about what's allowed and what's not allowed, and this specifically is dealing with the iPod Touch, which has Wi-Fi and not the old-school iPod that you have or the iPod Nano or the iPod Shuffle. Those are all fine because they can't be used to connect to the internet or to send and receive communications. But as you mentioned, more and more things these days have Wi-Fi built into it. My relatively new camera has Wi-Fi built into it, although I have yet to figure out how to use it. And my understanding is that at the musher meeting before the Iditarod this year, that they were told in no uncertain terms that they couldn't have iPhones and they couldn't have any device that could connect to the internet. So in terms of the rule being spelled out for them and it being very clear, you know, obviously it's a very unfortunate incident because Brent Sass is not only a top competitor, but also someone who is a really good ambassador for the sport. I saw the interview he did with the Iditarod Insider and heard an interview he did with Alaska Public Radio Network, and he was so admirable and astonishingly mature and came right out and said, this is my mistake. I goofed up. I had this and I shouldn't have had it and I didn't realize it. And and I had no intention of using it for cheating or anything. But when they asked me if I had it, I said, yes, I had it, and I realized they had to disqualify me. That's a pretty amazing thing for him to come out and say, and not to have any anger at the Iditarod or at the race officials. He apologized to his dogs and to his fellow mushers and to the Iditarod and to the fans, and said that it was just an honest mistake. And I believe him, and I think most people do. All that having been said, I think it might be time to take a second look at this rule and to consider whether that is something that is really necessary. Before there were GPS trackers on sleds, on all of the sleds, getting any kind of information about what was going on or what the other teams were doing was much more important. But these days, the mushers can go into any of the checkpoints, and race officials will have the GPS up, and it's relatively easy for them to ask for and get information on what is going on in other parts of the race. And I'm not sure that there is that much information that they can get, certainly from being connected through Wi-Fi. I can still see that you could make a case for not wanting to have people have cell phones or satellite phones, and where they could get a more immediate and direct help. But I'm not sure at this point what exactly they're trying to prevent in terms of the outside information that a musher would get.
It's my understanding that before the rule was enacted, there was one musher in particular that used to call down the trail on her cell phone and pretty much make dinner reservations on down the trail. They would call their handlers or their assistants or other people and say, okay, I'm such and such distance out, make sure dinner's ready. I heard that from from one of the Iditarod mushers. He isn't racing anymore, but he's a very well-respected musher. I don't think that he would, say something malicely. So I think, things like that where it gives them just a little bit of an edge, whether they're checking race results or whatever. But, again, I don't think Brent had any indications of doing that. It's just a very odd rule for this time in our lives where everything is so connected. So my last question on this, Alex, is what do you think about the penalty? The rules specifically say if you do this, you're disqualified. But kind of looking in hindsight, what is your opinion of that, not only as a fan, but also as somebody that follows this sport very closely?
It seems, I'm not criticizing them for disqualifying him. It seems to me like there would have been or could have been an opportunity to give him a lesser penalty, either a time penalty or a monetary penalty. And I think that would have made a lot of people feel a lot better about this. There have been reports, and I'm never sure how much credence to put into this, but there have been reports that other people have or other mushers had iPod touches as well. So technically, anybody else who had one could or should be disqualified. And people said, "Well, are you going to search the mushers to look for these?" And the race official said, "No, we're not going to search mushers." And there have been reports, and again, I'm not sure how much credence to put into this. A lot of mushers who had iPod touches are putting them in bags of their belongings to be sent back to Anchorage. So they're kind of getting rid of the evidence. It does seem to me that it's a little bit strange, and I think people would be more comfortable if there were a little bit greater clarity about what's allowed and making sure that the rules are enforced over everyone in the race and not just this person. I've also heard some speculation that there's you know, other top competitors wanted to get him out of the race. I don't know that I believe that. But I can, you know, I think you can be sure that next year everyone's going to be very, very clear about what they are and aren't allowed to have when they go down the trail.
My only statement to that, Alex, is when you said about the enforcement. And the way I look at it, it's sort of like a speeding ticket. You know, you can make a claim that everybody's going 75 miles an hour in a 65-mile-an-hour zone, but if you get pulled over and popped, you're the one getting a ticket, not the guy in front of you or behind you. So, you know, I think it's one of those things where, you know, a race official or whoever was doing the checking found it and had to enforce the rule regardless because it's a rule. But I do think that there will be changes. I don't know if there will be changes to allow them next year, but I definitely think that they will talk about it and make some type of an adjustment, either to allow some type of device or at least become very, very clear on what is going to happen if something is found. Do you agree?
I definitely agree. And, you know, the one other point I wanted to make is that for the vast majority of the race, there is no access to Wi-Fi. The Wi-Fi is primarily in the checkpoints along the route, and even in some of the checkpoints, the Wi-Fi is not very reliable or very strong. So really what we are talking about is something that only could be used when a musher or a team is in a checkpoint. And given that they already are able to get some of this information when they're in the checkpoint from the race officials or from the volunteers, it seems like I'm not exactly sure what the harm is to that. But as you said, I imagine this will be readdressed after this race.
So let's get into our other story. Happened earlier this afternoon. It kind of, kind of that news cycle that we live in, it pushed the Brent Sass story a little bit aside, and a major development in terms of really the sport of Iditarod happened today. Tell us the story, and then we'll talk about it a little bit, Alex.
So Lance Mackey, who I think anybody listening will know who Lance Mackey is, but for those who might not, Lance Mackey won four Iditarods in a row. The only person to do that comes from a great mushing family. His father won the Iditarod. His brother Rick won the Iditarod. And Lance really is someone who grew up with the sport and grew up with dogs and dog mushing. He also is a cancer survivor and has had some lingering problems because of the cancer and his treatment. And one of them is that he is very, very susceptible to cold, and especially his hands. And when he was in the checkpoint this afternoon and said that his dog team is doing great, the weather is great, the trail is great, but he is not doing well. And he showed his hands. His hands were blackened. He said that he had lost his mittens at one point on the trail and had to make do without them, and just didn't have very much feeling in his hands anymore, and was going to do his 24 in Tanana and hope that the feeling came back. But he also showed that he couldn't bend his fingers very far, and he said that he's not sure that he can take care of his dogs anymore. He's having trouble. He's having trouble putting booties on his dogs, and he said that he loves the sport and wants to continue with the sport, but doesn't think that he can. And said that this is likely to be his last Iditarod. And his brother Jason, who is also running, is taking his 24 there as well, and the two are going to travel together so that Jason can help Lance put booties on his dogs, because Lance doesn't think that he'll be able to continue doing that.
You know, Alex, again, a kind of a musher's perspective in regards to your hands. On Thanksgiving Day, I broke my middle finger on my left hand, typically the hand I use to pull my snow hook. And it was a pretty bad spiral fracture in the finger, and then several bones broken down into the lower hand. And I was out for a good portion of the season. I wasn't able to get back on the sled until mid-February because of that, because I could not pull my hook out of the snow. It just wasn't possible to do. And in mushing, you're either holding on to the handlebar with one hand and pulling on the hook with the other. So I know how much your hands and your fingers and the dexterity in those is required to do something like put on booties or undo snaps or the mundane everyday tasks that you have to do as a musher time in and time out on the trail. So I can imagine just how much pain he's in. But, you know, back to the brother part of it, that's the real inspiration. His brother said, you know what, I'm going to follow along with my brother and we're going to do this together. And I know that they did this together before. I believe it was in Jason's first Iditarod. His brother's name is Jason. And they ended up coming in 24th and 26th. I believe Jason was in 24th. Don't quote me on that, but they came in very close together, but very respectable finish. But it looks like they're going to travel down the trail and help each other. But that's not an uncommon occurrence, is it, Alex? A lot of teams do that. They travel great distances down the trail and help each other out and, you know, kind of have that camaraderie going for hundreds of miles down the trail. I know you have several stories about that, not only in your movie, but in the accounts that you and I've talked about over and over on this show.
Yeah, and, you know, perhaps most famously in the past couple of years, the Barrington twins, Anna and Christy Barrington, have traveled together for long portions of Iditarod. And there usually are groups, especially in the middle and the back of the pack, where two or three teams will just travel together, and you can help me out from a musher's perspective, but I would imagine that is more fun. It's probably safer if anything happens than you would have someone who's nearby who could help out. If there was an encounter with an animal or if one of the dogs got loose or something like that. And I just think that sounds like it would be a great way to, you know, to be able to see that part of Alaska.
The only issue I have ever had with traveling with people is obviously the person, whoever's behind you, is constantly chasing that team in front. So they're constantly having to put on the brake and wait and, you know, it's more of a stop-start motion. And it's very taxing, not only on the musher, but also on the dog. So, they don't travel together in terms of packs, meaning, you know, side-by-side down the trail and maybe even within talking distance. I would imagine, even if they're just a couple of miles separating them, they're still able to come to the checkpoint at relatively the same times. They leave at the same time, and they can travel that way. And I too agree. It's got to be a very nice way to get down the trail, knowing that somebody's there to, you know, not only to travel with, but also to talk to at checkpoints or at camps along the trail. It's got to be a good way, like you said, to see Alaska.
Yeah. And as you said, it's really wonderful and touching that Jason is essentially sacrificing the performance of his own race so that he can help Lance get to know.
Right.
In the interview that I saw with Lance, when he was talking about not being able to continue, he was so emotional about it, and it was clear that if there's ever been any question, it was clear that this is someone who completely and totally loves the sport and loves his dogs, and his real concern right now doesn't have anything to do with the race, but just has to do with being able to take care of his dogs.
Did you get a chance to see what Danny Seavey wrote on their Facebook page? I thought that was a remarkable testimony, not only to the sport of mushing, but also to Lance.
Yeah, I did, and I've seen a number of people have posted some wonderful things about Lance, and you know, I keep coming back to, there's a famous, I don't know if it was a bumper sticker or something, but the saying, Superman wears Lance Mackey pajamas.
Right.
Because it's hard to underestimate how dominant Lance Mackey was, especially between, you know, 2007 and 2010. When he won the four straight Iditarods, he had also won four straight Yukon Quest races. He was, when he ran the Yukon Quest and then immediately ran Iditarod, people thought that this was ridiculous and that no one could possibly do very well. And then after winning the Yukon Quest as a rookie, he came in seventh in the Iditarod in, I believe, 2005. And then people really, really stood up and took notice of this. And then in 2007, he won the Quest and then won Iditarod and then came back in 2008 and won both of them again. And at that point, people started realizing that there was something very different and special about the way sled dogs react after they've been running for a long time and how they actually can become much more efficient after they've run for several hundred miles. And, you know, Lance Mackey is someone who has a legendary intuitive communication with his dogs and would famously sleep in his dog yard and, you know, could just give his dogs a look and they would know exactly what he wanted and what he needed. You know, this is a guy who, because of the cancer, had his salivary glands cut out of his throat. And that's why if you ever see Lance, he's always got a bottle of water around because he doesn't salivate. He has to keep drinking water to keep himself hydrated. As a result of that, he had a lot of dental problems and wound up losing a lot of his teeth. This past year, he had massive amounts of dental surgery and went into a lot of debt for that. And some of his friends and fans started a crowdfunding drive to pay for this dental work and raised an enormous amount of money very, very quickly. And from what I've heard from Lance's, from people who are close to Lance, he was very surprised by the outpouring of support and generosity. And I don't think had realized until this happened how much he means to fans of dog mushing.
Alex, if you don't mind, let me jump in here real
sure.
quick. If you don't mind, Alex, let's go over a little bit tonight. I want to make sure that we talk about what's going to happen in the next day or so. So if you don't mind standing in, we are going to record a little bit. And if you're listening live, you can hear us on iTunes or on Mushing Radio as soon as the show is over. Go ahead, Alex, with what you were saying.
Yeah, I was just going to say that when I first started making my transition between being a casual fan and someone who is frankly obsessed with Iditarod, it was at the point when Lance was so dominant. And it was always really fun to see interviews with him, to listen to him trash talking Jeff King. They had a huge rivalry during all of that time. And Lance was one of those people who was just so focused on the sport and so at the top of his game that he could just do these things that seemed impossible. And, you know, this is a guy who, I should remind people, after his cancer, he had a lot of nerve pain in his fingers, and it was the nerve damage was so bad that he actually had the index finger on his left hand removed because it was too painful. So this is a guy who has nine fingers and still was able to come in and take care of his dogs and do all of those things despite the fact that his hands are very, very sensitive to cold. And it was much harder for him and took more out of him to be out in the cold than it does for most people. The other thing I wanted to mention real quickly, and I believe we've talked about this before, but it bears repeating. I was so impressed when I first met Lance and when I first observed Lance with Sands and how he takes time to interact with people and really connect with people. Most mushers are very friendly and supportive of their fans, but some of them, I think, especially at the top, maybe take their fans a little bit for granted. And I have seen him being so patient and spending so much time with people, and it's really remarkable. The other thing I wanted to mention is when I was in Nome at the end of the 2010 race, which was the fourth race that he won, I was impressed by the fact that he made a point coming out to greet every one of the finishers while I was there. And this is, you know, the last six or seven racers who came in. And I remember thinking to myself, here's a guy who has won four Iditarods in a row, who is a cancer survivor, who looks like things have beaten him up a little bit and is not as strong and robust as other people. And if anyone deserved to just sleep in and relax rather than coming out to Front Street and standing under the Burled Arch with sometimes as few as 20 people to greet someone and congratulate them, it's Lance Mackey. And yet he made a point to come out and to be one of the first people to welcome these mushers into Nome and congratulate them. And I think that speaks so much about who he is and what a deep understanding he has of the achievement of anyone who completes the Iditarod, whether you're in first place or last place. And that is something that I will that I always keep with me when I think about Lance Mackey.
What do you think is going to happen next to Lance? There's been a lot of alluding to it over the last few hours. What's your opinion? What do you think he's going to be up for Lance Mackey in the future?
A lot of people have said that that maybe rather than doing long-distance mushing, he could try his hand at sprint racing, where he wouldn't have to be in the cold for as long, and the amount of dog care that he would have to do is much, much less. It seems clear to me that he is going to stay involved in some way with the sport. And I hope that whether it's through sprint racing or something else, that he's able to find something that makes him happy and lets him spend a lot of time with the dogs.
And you know, he did that last year. Last year he did not run the Quest or the Iditarod, but he took some time off to run the Fur Rondi races down here in Anchorage, one of the largest sprint races in the world, and also the Tok Race of Champions just up north in Tok, Alaska. So he has done sprint mushing very recently and did relatively well. Of course, distance dogs run a lot differently than those very speedy sprint dogs, especially the Eurohound mixes, the floppy-eared dogs, if you will, where they go 18, 19 miles an hour, where a typical Iditarod pace is about 8 to 10 miles an hour.
Yeah, and, you know, I should mention just briefly that I've heard Lance make sometimes make statements in the past that seem designed to get attention or that seem hyperbolic. And I've heard him, you know, threaten to retire and threaten to go off and run races in Europe. And then I've heard him sometimes when he's had dog teams that aren't as strong to make claims about them that seem designed to scare his competitors. But watching this interview with him this afternoon, it seemed like this was a totally different thing. It seemed like this is someone who is recognizing that he just can't physically go on, you know, and I am hopeful, and I think everyone is hopeful, that he will be able to finish this race.
Let's hope so, for sure. I think he's going to be able to finish, especially if his brother is there with him. I'm sure that just about anybody out there on the trail will lend a helping hand. They will do that for just about anybody. If that's just kind of the nature of the sport. If you see a musher that needs assistance, you help them out, and I think they will definitely do that for Lance. If we can, real quickly, Alex, I know we are recording now. I have no idea what you got going on this evening, but what's happening in the next couple of days? We're going to be back on the air on Friday. What's going to happen over the next couple of days on Iditarod in terms of trail, where the folks are going to go, and how do you see it shaking out?
Well, I think we're going to start seeing the field get separated a lot more. One of the things that is going to happen is the mandatory rests will come into play. Teams have to take a mandatory 8-hour rest anywhere on the Yukon River. So I believe that's from Tanana to Caltag. And then there's also a mandatory 24-hour rest, which can be taken at any of the checkpoints. Some of the teams already have taken their 8-hour rests. I know Hugh Neff did, and Martin Boozer, and other teams like Ali Zirkel and Mitch Seavey and Dallas Seavey took a much shorter rest in Tanana and then left. So I believe Ali took a rest of 4.5 hours, and Mitch and Dallas were, I believe, around 5 hours each. Rather than staying for the 8 hours or an extra 3 hours and getting their 8-hour mandatory rest out of the way, they chose to leave a little bit earlier, which means that at some point in the next few checkpoints, they will have to be taking an 8-hour rest, whereas teams like Hugh Neff and Martin Boozer can leave earlier because they've already taken that rest. As I mentioned, the Tanana to Ruby leg is extremely long for the Iditarod. It is, I believe it's 120 miles or 119 miles, which is much longer than typical distance between checkpoints in Iditarod. It's much more of a Yukon Quest type of distance. And that has been very interesting to watch, because 120 miles is usually too long to just take at one on one long run. So teams have been dividing it up into two or three shorter runs and then resting at cabins, or there's a Bible camp where a number of teams were resting during the day today. So that's going to be really interesting. I know that Ellen Halverson, who is the who's currently the Red Lantern, already won two Red Lanterns in the Iditarod. I believe she's the only person who's won the Red Lantern twice, and I would have to imagine she's looking to avoid winning it a third time. Other than that, I think that the we are going to have a really tight and exciting race at the front. I've said before that in any given year, it seems like there's between 12 and 15 teams that could win, given the right breaks. And it looks like there, the teams that we're seeing in the top 10 right now, it seems that almost any one of them could conceivably go on to win Iditarod this year.
And just to bring up the 24-hour rest again, I know we mentioned this briefly the other day, but when a person does take their 24-hour break, they also adjust the time differential from when they start. So the person that started first, who left at 10:02 a.m. on Monday, will stay in that checkpoint for 24 hours, 2 minutes, versus the last musher, who I believe is who is that, Alex? Do you know right off the top?
I believe that Zoya Denner.
Zoya. She has to stay in the checkpoint 26 hours, 15 minutes or so. So she'll have to stay there little longer. And as
the other way around, she gets just the 24, and then the first teams have to wait longer.
Oh, okay, that's what it is. I'm sorry, I got
right.
That backwards. And as I mentioned the other day, that is when the race will really begin to shake out. After all of those teams have taken their 24s and everybody's on equal ground, so to speak, because up until then, you will see a team that is resting, and then one that came up from behind them will blow past them, and they'll move up very quickly in the rankings, and that person that is resting will fall way back in the rankings. But that will quickly equalize itself after everybody's taken their 24 and they're on their way along. Most of them will take it there in Ruby or a little bit further down, and the race will really start to shake out then, and we'll have a pretty good idea, as you mentioned. 10, 12, 14 teams now have a real shot of really shooting and riding that bullet pretty quickly out of their 24 and on down the trail.
Right, and that sometimes can lead to some interesting anomalies in the standings. We saw a couple years ago Trent Herbst, who's running near the back right now, Trent Herbst opted to take his 24 much later, so almost everyone else had taken their 24 before him, and he kept going and was the first musher to the halfway point, and there was a prize associated with that, which was, I'm not sure, I believe several thousand dollars or perhaps several thousand dollars in gold, and he kept going so that he could win that prize, then took his 24. While he was taking his 24, 30 or 40 teams passed him. So he was temporarily the furthest team in the lead, but couldn't really be said to be winning the race.
Right. Exactly. All right, Alex, we are out of time here. We will be back on the air Friday night at 6 o'clock. Anything you want to talk about on Friday to give people a heads up, or we're going to see how it pans out?
I think we're going to see how it pans out. There this time last year with the really bad trail conditions, we had a lot of scratches. I think we might have had over a dozen scratches by this time last year. This year, no scratches so far, and everyone is still in the race except for Brent Sass.
Right. So I hope all of them do very well. I'm always hoping that very few will scratch, but that's kind of the nature of the beast. It's a tough, tough race. 1,000 miles for a dog team is a long way. Alex, it was a pleasure as always. We'll talk on Friday, and make sure you follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and check out Alex. He's at Coldfoot Films on Twitter. Very active there, and he will continue the commentary. It seems like almost 24 hours a day. So, Alex, get some sleep over the next couple of days, and we'll talk then, okay?
Thanks, Robert.
Thank you. We'll see you guys next time. Goodbye.